You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 3rd of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and just down the road from the Monocle Cafe. I'm Emma Nelson on today's show.
It was deeply shocking. I mean, piracy charge is one that carries a huge sentence and is totally disproportionate to what the activists were doing and what Kieran as a freelance journalist, which, you know, he's not a Greenpeace member, he's not an activist at all.
Russia charges Greenpeace activists and a British journalist with piracy. We'll speak to the man's brother, and Robert Fox and James Boyes will tell us what's next. Then it's day three of the US government shutdown. We'll take stock of a crisis where either side is still yet to blink. And look away now, unless you'd quite like to take a peek, of course, we'll explore the decorous but jaw-dropping world of antique Japanese erotica.
The native religion of Japan, there's very little sense that sex or the pursuit of sexual pleasure is inherently sinful. In fact, quite the reverse. And Shunga promotes a very positive view of sex, I think, to an extent an idealized view, some would say a fantasy view, but that is the nature of the art.
I'm blushing. Plus, we'll head to the Monocle Cafe to explore an Arab cultural festival, and we'll play you some music too, and we'll look ahead to the rest of the day here on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo with me, Emma Nelson, right now. So plenty to sink our teeth into in the next hour here on Aperitivo. Before that, Jonathan Wheatley has the latest world news.
At least 94 people have died and up to 250 are missing after a boat packed with African migrants caught fire and sank off the Sicilian island of Lampedusa. The disaster occurred when the boat's motor stopped working and the vessel began to take on water. People on board burnt a sheet to attract the attention of rescuers, starting a fire on board. 140 people have been rescued. The EU Commission said the European Union should step up its fight against people smuggling networks and open up more legal ways for people to enter Europe. Michele Saccone is the spokesman for the EU Commissioner for Home Affairs.
Behind this tragedy and many other tragedies, there are criminals and criminal networks who are exploiting human beings in despair. And the reality is that smuggling is a crime that is generating huge profits for these networks. So we really have to step up our efforts.
With the federal government shut down in the United States in its third day, President Obama has warned the US could be facing an even bigger financial crisis if the standoff is not resolved quickly. If a deal can't be reached by the middle of October, the US government will run out of cash. Republican Congressman Roger Williams from Texas said the shutdown was the fault of the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid.
Last night, House Republicans once again showed up and took action to stop the bleeding of Harry Reid's government shutdown. President Obama has already bullied the House by threatening to veto these important bills to protect our nation's veterans, keep D.C. schools and services open, and preserve and reopen our national parks.
Perhaps not surprisingly, the Senate Democrat leader, Harry Reid, blames the Republicans for now insisting on delaying the impact of the Affordable Health Care Act, which had already been passed months ago.
The President of the United States was very, very strong. This has never happened before. They can make all the historical analysis that they want. It just has never happened before where a political party would be willing to take the country to the brink of financial disaster and say, we're not going to allow us to pay our bills.
India says its military is fighting a group who crossed the disputed border in Kashmir. Officials say that for more than a week they've been holed up in thick forests close to the line of control. Generals say the fighting's been going on for more than a week. Nirmala Sitharaman speaks for India's main opposition party.
This is a big shame that when the Indian government and the Prime Minister in particular was in talking with Pakistani Prime Minister about peace in the region, here is a forceful occupation of what is essentially an Indian territory.
And the UN Security Council has urged Syria's government to allow international aid to be delivered to areas badly affected by the country's civil war. Aid Chief Valerie Amos said that if requests on aid access were implemented fully, then humanitarian groups could help some 2 million people in Syria who have for many months been unreachable.
If the parties to the conflict observe the call of the United International Community and meet their obligations under international humanitarian and human rights laws, they will stop targeting innocent women, children and men, and civilian services and infrastructure, and we will see fewer lives lost and fewer violations of human rights.
She also urged the UN to make more of an effort to help refugees from Syria.
In the region, we should see greater and more united support to those communities and governments hosting refugees and to the refugees themselves.
And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Jonathan. It's one of those things I think a lot of people have taken their eye off the ball a bit, is the Syrian refugee crisis. When you have, I think it's an article in Der Spiegel saying that a lot of the spillover into Lebanon, for example, the Syrians are actually, the refugees that are getting there are not wishing to leave. They're trying to make their permanent home. And so it's one of those things that we've been talking about so much about the geopolitical aspect of it. And yet the focus must be on the people who are stuck in the middle of the conflict.
And they're stuck in all these countries like Jordan, Turkey as well. All those neighbouring countries are facing a crisis for money and aid. And when is it going to end?
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. You're with Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We're back right after this with our studio guests.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Via Monocle, para City Cheche.
From London,
London, Caracas.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're with Aperitivo. The time here in London is 1307 in New York. Joining me now to take with their take on the news here in the studios is Robert Fox, defence editor at London's Evening Standard, and Dr. James Boyes, visiting senior research fellow at King's College London. Welcome both gentlemen to the programme. Robert, you came in blazing a trail in the possible end of the Daily Mail's reign as the great newspaper of God knows what ending happening.
Unvarnished honesty, truth, record, applehood and mother pie, you know. No, it is the great mid-market populist newspaper, yeah. And it has been more Tory than the Tories. And there is one person in the UK above all others this morning, listeners, or this evening, wherever you are, who just wishes that the Daily Mail could find a great big hole under Piccadilly Circus and disappear in it. And that is our Prime Minister, Mr. David Cameron, because they claim to be the great Tory Conservative newspaper. And with friends like that, who needs to try and win general elections?
And in the meantime, James Boyes, Paul Dacre, the editor, has gone AWOL.
Absolutely. And one wonders where he's going to end up. Of course, with the Conservative Party conference this week, it's a sort of distraction that the Prime Minister could well do without, quite frankly.
It is something that the British will be absolutely fascinated by for the next few weeks.
I do think, by the way, our American audience is going to be very interesting, because it's going to be the freedom of press laws are going to come up, and it puts everything in the melting pot, which in a cunning way is what the Daily Mail wanted. But their behaviour has been beyond outrageous, and I'm a dinosaur journalist of 46 years' experience.
Well, I shall be asking the dinosaur then about a great two topics that we're talking about today. We're going to be talking about Greenpeace and, of course, day three of the so-called government shutdown. Let's begin with Greenpeace, shall we? We heard about it in the news. The charging of 14 Greenpeace activists in Russia, the authorities have accused them of piracy. A crime, if found guilty, can land you 15 years in prison. They were among the crew of a ship protesting against Russian drilling in the Arctic. Among them on board, Kieran Bryan, a British freelance journalist. He'd been hired by Greenpeace to film their activity. His brother, Russell, told me a little earlier how he thought Kieran was doing in a Russian prison.
The last time my folks spoke to him, it was 10 days ago. And at that point, they just arrived back into Murmansk whilst he was under detention from the Russian, I think they're called the FSB. He had been relatively well treated on the boat, I believe, by, you know, they were obviously all detained and in one room, but, you know, they were, you know, not badly treated. And then when they arrived back into Murmansk, he spoke with my parents on the following day, and since then we haven't heard from him at all. We've had no contact We know very little about where he's being kept, other than it's a detention centre, what kind of condition it is. You know, we have conflicting reports on conditions in Russian detention centres, and we did hear reports from Greenpeace that some of the people on the ship had been concerned with the food that they were getting, but certainly nothing from Kieran since about 10 days ago.
Russell Bryan there, the brother of Kieran Bryan, a British freelance journalist who is hired by Greenpeace to film Greenpeace's activity in the Arctic. He was arrested and has subsequently been charged with piracy by the Russians. James, this is something straight out of Kafka.
Possibly.
However, for Kieran Bryan, perhaps at least.
Well, let's put it this way: one sympathises with any British national languishing in a foreign jail. But let's be honest about this: Greenpeace is a lobby group. It's there to promote its ideas, and the fact that this has happened has given them a far greater platform to talk about. The fact that we're talking about it now is basically ammunition to them. If he hadn't been arrested, if they weren't languishing in prison, they aren't going to go to prison for 15 years. Let's be honest about it. It's a great platform for them. And as a result of that, they're going to get a lot more mileage out of this. And I have a funny feeling that Robert's going to agree with that.
That's all nodding.
Yeah, I'm afraid. Greenpeace know what they're up to.
Absolutely.
And they're in it for publicity. And they're commercial, too. They want to sell their product. And I do feel sorry for the freelancers, because if Kieran didn't know what he was getting himself into, I wish somebody in his family who was the professional journalist had told him all about it. It is very hard ball, this, because they have trod on the toes, probably, of a big corporate mineral and mining and oil extraction company. I would guess it's the great empire of Gazprom.
Absolutely.
And you do have to understand, it's not only Gazprom, but Norwegian Statoil. They regard themselves almost as states. You know what you're doing. They feel that they must guard their security and they must guard their commercial secrets. I'm not justifying it. And by the way, they're making huge mileage, and good for them. Lucky for them, Greenpiece, that they have been charged with private piracy. Thinking of the chief product of the FSB, one Vladimir Putin, he said he actually has gone on the record and said, no, this isn't piracy.
He has nonetheless said this is a breaking of international law. And you get the impression, though, that you have someone like Kieran Bryan being caught up in something. I mean, are you honestly saying that Greenpeace would actively go out to endanger or place not only their employees, but someone to whom they owe a professional duty of care in that degree of risk?
That is not what I'm saying, but it's rather like the row over the BBC freelance expedition into North Korea. These things are laden with risk. A thing as experienced as Greenpeace really knows about this, and they really should have explained it to those people they were employing for a publicity job. Kieran is there doing publicity. It's his job. That's what he is trained to do. But they must know that is precisely not what the Russians don't want. So there is contest. It is contested space. So the likelihood of trouble is there. That's all that I'm saying.
I mean, fundamentally, Emma, they've gone out of their way. I mean, what do Greenpeace do? You know, they're not sort of protesting politely here. They are making an assault in the eyes of Gazprom upon their property. And you mess with Mr. Abramovich at your peril, quite frankly. You know, people forget. People just look at him in this country and think, oh, he's the guy who runs Chelsea, but he's an oligarch. I mean, the guy is, you know, absolutely central to the financing of Russia with Gazprom. We understand. I think we misunderstand what that organisation is all about. You know, they're fundamentally behind the Putin administration, and people mess with them at their peril. The Greenpeace have gone out of their way to protest against it, and ultimately, it's a great piece of propaganda. They've been suggesting a 15-year term. Nobody believes they're going to serve that. Putin actually is coming out of this almost looking quite reasonable by saying, well, they're not international pirates. There's a degree of international law that's been broken, perhaps the laws of the sea, perhaps. But it's a bit like the whole Pussy Riot thing. It's terrible local propaganda, but I think ultimately something perhaps it will come out of this.
What do you think will come out of this? I mean, you mentioned the fact that Greenpeace are very, very strong attention seekers. Mm-hmm. It seems to be their sort of raison d'être. But they've been pulling stunts like this for four decades plus. Is this not more a story about Gazprom and the way that the Russian system is now shifting direction, that people are eager to perhaps reflect what they believe to be Putin's ideas. You get that idea that we've spoken to Ben Judah, who is an expert on Russia, and he talks about the idea of working towards the dictator.
Well, I think what you definitely see is the fact that Putin is desperately trying to reassert Russian place on the world stage. If you lived through the 1990s, you saw the rather jocular clown figure of Boris Yeltsin turning up drunk, trying to order pizza, wandering around the South Lawn of the White House in his underwear. I think Vladimir Putin is never going to fall into that category.
And he learnt from that too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this idea that he's trying to reassert Russia on the world stage, you see that in his dealings with Syria at this point in time. And he's quite clearly doesn't want to be seen as anyway the fool that Yeltsin was. And I think what you're seeing here is perhaps, local action being taken by the Murmansk authorities that the central authorities are trying to have to deal with. You know, we sometimes look at Russia as a unified state. Look at the size of it. You know, it spreads like nine time zones. The degree to which Putin's responsible for this is questionable, I think. And I think he's possibly, in his language, going to try and walk this back to a point where you'll see Greenpeace activists charged, but perhaps released after a very short period of time.
It is nonetheless, as you know, the whole point of the whole way that communist Russia worked was it had this central control point, and you went out to the regions, all of which wanted to do this working towards a dictator. Let's hear from how Ben Judah's take on how this whole operation might be centrally controlled indirectly by the Kremlin.
In political science, there's a term of like working towards the dictator, is that in authoritarian countries, be it China or Iran, and especially Russia, and this is how it works in Russia, judges and officials are not all connected in to Putin's office by email or special secret phone switches. What they're doing is trying to work out what he wants and work towards him. So Russian courts, in general, do not receive directions from the Kremlin. What they do is that they read the newspapers and they read government propaganda and they try to work out what the Kremlin would want. So in interviews I've done with judges who have been involved in big political cases like charges towards Kasparov or the Khodorkovsky, the infamous Khodorkovsky cases, what they often tell is that they're so frightened of passing a judgment that the Kremlin would not like, because that would involve losing their job and their status, their benefits, often very good deals on apartments, so on and so forth, that they push judgments that could even be more reactionary than the Kremlin would like, because they're frightened of doing otherwise. So I would be surprised if someone in Putin's cabinet had given a direction towards these piracy charges. But what I am certain of is that the local officials in the northern province where the activity was taking place, the local judges were told by Moscow they were extremely irritated with Greenpeace, and that in that context of clampdown on NGOs and in the context of rising government propaganda against foreign interference, there was a decision taken probably by a local judge and a local court to go that one step further.
Robert Fox, defence editor at the London's Evening Standard, you are shaking your head at that.
Well, I simply can't comment. I'm not a Russian speaker. I don't know the evidence. There wasn't evidence produced there. Sorry, this is commentary arty gone mad. Yes, we know that it's a combinat, and there's always been that conception, as James would say. It's a peculiarly Russian thing. Actually, the greatest exponent of the combinat in politics, and he's just disappeared or disappearing from Italian politics, is Silvio Berlusconi, who somehow thought that Mediaset, his great empire, was part of the Italian state and the Italian state was Mediaset. It's that kind of thing. When you're interpolating symbiotic thinking like this, yes, I know you can say that he's Boris Godunov or Ivan the Terrible. All these analogies don't work. Actually, whatever you say about Vladimir Putin, and it's not a moral judgment, he is very much a 21st century figure. He has got to protect Gazprom because it's almost a monoculture now, as we know. This sprawling empire that I'm talking about, land empire in terms of human geography. And the great thing that we know, and he's spoken about it, and he's spoken actually very evocatively, whether this whole thing is going to hold together. They've got a demographic decline. It's not a collapse. They've got a demographic switch, and therefore he has got to keep the state going. I don't think, and I think our commentator seemed to argue himself in circles and say, yes, they were doing things, but there was no order from the Kremlin. Yes, I think there is a symbiosis. I think he's right there. That's quite clearly what is going on.
But the thinking of the combinat, the economic model, they've got to protect Gazprom. What is so interesting, compared with the spy scandals and so on, and the very serious problems that the UK has had of late with Moscow, Vladimir Putin's been pretty mild in his rhetoric about this. He hasn't been jumping up and down, exposing the Superman logo on his chest and saying this is an outrage to the Russian people. We must defend it. And it seems to me he's saying, bad boys, they don't like it because my combinat, my big company, doesn't like it. And he's really saying, particularly that remark about piracy, that he's prepared to do a deal and he's looking to do a deal, I think.
Robert, you mentioned there the idea of the difficulties that the British government have been going through. One thing that struck me is how silent that the British government has been in this whole business. And talking to Russell Bryan, who's the brother of Kieran Bryan, the British freelance journalist who is in prison in Russia at the moment, charged with piracy, He spoke to me a little bit earlier on about what he thought the United Kingdom government was doing to try to help his brother.
The British government, we've got contact at the Foreign Office. We're still unsure about how often Kieran has been seen by them. And I know that he has had contact with them at the two trial dates, the two court dates so far. Other than that, I'm not sure how much he's seen anyone else.
James, what are your thoughts on the way that the British government is handling this? Is this the toxicity of Greenpeace which is stopping the UK from wading in?
I think we have to be careful not to personalise this. Mm. I mean, it seems to me there's a great push here to talk about the role of an individual and his family and how they're being treated. But fundamentally, let me be honest here, it is not the role of the United Kingdom, Her Majesty's government, to start going around trying to back up the actions of an international non-governmental organisation in the form of Greenpeace. Whilst one doesn't want to see British nationals languishing overseas, they are there. They weren't there as a private citizen. They were there as part of an activist attempt to draw attention to the actions of Gazprom. They've managed to do that. Why should our taxpayers' input effectively go towards trying to get the British government to advocate on behalf of Greenpeace to get people out of jail? I don't believe anybody thinks that these people are going to be languishing there that long, certainly not for 15 years. If that was the case, that's a different situation. This is all about propaganda for Greenpeace, and boy, oh boy, are they getting it.
But as an old-style hack, can I say the worst thing the family can do, I'm sorry, and I know they want to air their anxiety, and I share that pain with them over there, is to talk about it in public. Yeah. Because what the FCO will be doing, they'll be working, they won't be demanding, because demanding doesn't work in megaphone diplomacy. They will be trying to get the maximum consular access and to be there. They will request the right, of course, to be there at each and every one of the hearings. But this is where actually the megaphone, which is the sword by which Greenpeace itself lives, don't help all that much.
You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24 with Emma Nelson, joined by Robert Fox and James Boyd. Back in a moment, we'll ask why, then, after 3 days, the US government is still shutting down.
The Glenlivet was the first single malt to successfully cross the Atlantic Ocean. And since that first journey, the world-renowned whiskey has never looked back. Now, master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting their global community of whisky connoisseurs, the guardians of the Glenlivet, to help create their next limited edition whisky. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. Still with me, Robert Fox, Defence Editor at London's Evening Standard, and Dr. James Boyes, Visiting Senior Research Fellow at King's College London. Now, there's still no deal between the Republicans and Democrats. Top-level talks to try to break the deadlock over the US finance bill have ended without any further progress. And as a result, the government shutdown continues. And thoughts now turn to October the 17th, when the US borrowing limit is reached. In the last past 24 hours, we've had warnings from President Obama about the long-term damage that the country is risking. Top-ranking members of the US banking sector have met the president and are lobbying Congress to come to some sort of deal. And the head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, has warned about the effects of the US defaulting in 2 weeks. James, this is absolutely your bag. Christine Lagarde said this is the greatest macroeconomic crisis to hit the world for some time. What are your thoughts?
Well, can I just congratulate you on playing right into Barack Obama's hands by conflating completely different issues here, which is exactly what he's been doing all along. There's several issues here. First of all, what's been trying to get done here? The House and the Senate and the White House have been completely unable to agree to a budget. So they've been trying to get a continuing resolution passed for the last couple of weeks, if not months. The fact that the United States government can't agree upon a budget is terrible enough. The fact that the White House is unprepared to negotiate with Republicans is terrible enough. But what the president is now doing is he's trying to bring into the mix this idea of the fair faith and credit of the United States with regard to the deficit project, with the, you know, raising the debt ceiling, which is completely unrelated. There's no doubt that we need to get beyond this current debacle before we move to that point. But by trying to bring the two together and suggesting that Republicans are bringing into doubt the financial viability of the United States is a terrible, terrible approach to be taking, and it is fundamentally dishonest.
I was wondering, though, I was thinking the very self same thing this afternoon when I suddenly found myself being, like you say, being drawn into both issues. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, big players in the world have started to draw comparisons. It all started about 48 hours ago when the likes of JP, you know, the head honchos from JP Morgan Chase were striding towards the White House, demanding that Congress sorts itself out before this debt ceiling is reached on October the 17th. So it is almost something that others have brought to the fore. Robert, you're laughing.
Well, I was really coming onto your programme because, of course, I would love to talk about Silvio Berlusconi.
You can in a minute.
But
it's
the
all
thing
yours.
Is, what I was going to say, I was going to use an Italian expression. Sorry, because Italian is my second language and it's lovely in politics, but it's just in life because everybody knows about la bella figura. The opposite of a bella figura is brutta figura. And this is exactly what is going on in America. Congress and Obama are conducting themselves so badly because this could have been spotted a mile away. This is, James, how many? This is the third time in how many years we've had this collision and threats of shutting down and on one occasion an actual shutting down. And this is the home of the land of the free, of applehood and mother pie and... Obama himself, and this is where Putin was very clever in that writing that letter about Syria to him, bangs on about American exceptionalism, where they seem to be running an exceptionally bad democracy at the moment, because there are a lot of, James and I were talking about this before he came in, there are a lot of hidden things underneath this. The way Republican states, have been gerrymandering boundaries. It's looking like a very odd and leaky ship. And if they're prepared to run it to the edge, Tom Friedman, my great friend and colleague, has a wonderful column today in the New York Times, said, is this really the way you run a democracy? Is a democracy is the way a minority, which actually is not the way the Tea Party elements see themselves, but they are a minority, finds the means of holding all the rest to ransom. There's that on the other side. The other thing that we're seeing, sorry, James and I are becoming very boring, James, we're repeating ourselves, it's proved yet again what a lousy politician Obama is.
I tell you something that was very fascinating here. Just jump in there. Barack Obama used to be a constitutional law professor at Chicago University. And one of the things he came out with the other day was a quote. I'm going to try and quote him directly, which is this, that one faction of one party in one division of government cannot be allowed to shut down the American system of government. Well, I'm very sorry, but anybody who's practiced and understands constitutional law will realize that that is exactly what they can and have done. The American system of government was set up to frustrate the passage of legislation to ensure that to get anything done, you have to compromise. And this president has proven time and time again his unwillingness to compromise. One does not need, and I certainly do not support the Tea Party, to recognize the absurdity of the situation where you have an American president who's prepared to negotiate with the Iranians, but not with his fellow Americans.
You talk about the idea of constitutional law, but... yes, okay, we have the idea that, you know, no law is permanently binding. You can always undo a law by repealing it or amending it or whatever. Uh-huh. But the point must remain is that the Obamacare bill, which is the great, you know, problem in the whole of this argument has gone through law. It is signed into law. It has been approved by the Senate.
And the Supreme Court, too.
And the Supreme Court. It's done and dusted. It should be in the past.
It's important to note, though, to get it through the Supreme Court, the White House said one thing in regard to public with regard to whether it was a tax or not, and one thing to the Supreme Court about whether it was a tax or not, to get it, make sure that it was seen as being constitutional. The fact of the matter, however, is that if you were a member of the House of Representatives and you are up for re-election every 2 years, you are reflecting the will of your constituents to a degree to which Barack Obama may not be. These people have got absolutely no need to back down. If you look at their support within the congressional districts, which are getting more and more conservative, and again, look at what Politico is putting forward together, look at what the New York Times is talking about today, Ashley Parker's piece, this idea that somehow the White House is going to force the House of Representatives to back down may well be hiding to nothing. I don't know not where this is going to end up, but it's not going to be pretty.
Robert, I'm going to let you have your way. You wanted to talk about Italy. It's something that we've thought about here on Monocle 24, that in the last couple of days we've seen two dysfunctional governments, two lots of strong characters, but one lot, namely Berlusconi in Italy, backing down and letting Letta have his way and a vote of confidence in the Letta government going ahead. We spoke to Jenny Riotto, the Italian journalist and former editor of Il Sole 24 Ore. He said that Washington is beginning to look a little bit like Rome gone wrong.
I think today there is something in common, and is that the Conservative Party, the Republican Party, and Berlusconi's party in Italy are gripped and blocked by extremists, and both parties do not understand how the global, international, modern, contemporary world is working, and they are stuck to ideological positions.
Very quickly, Robert, we've run out of time, but last word to you on that.
Two heroes, Enrico Letta, remarkable success. He said, do you want to bring the House of Cards down, and it will be the whole thing. It could affect the euro, it will affect the whole eurozone. And the wonderful 88-year-old, by the way, Daily Mail, former Marxist, Giorgio Napolitano, head of state, Italy's most senior judge, said you've been sentenced to jail, you've had all your appeals, you've got to fulfil your sentence, Mr. Berlusconi, on October the 15th, and then he's out of politics. It's the end of the Berlusconi era.
Robert Fox, defence editor at London's Evening Standard. Congratulations for letting the last word be on Berlusconi. And Dr. James Boyes, visiting senior research fellow at King's College London. Thank you both, gentlemen, for joining us here on The Aperitivo.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
Londen-Europa, Monocle 24입니다.
Op Londen, du var Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London-Europa,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Robert Fox departing the studio, saying next time he wants a little bit more controversy. Still to come in the second half of today's programme, however, we'll head to the Monocle Café for a chat about an Arab culture festival, and we'll preview what's coming up on today's Globalist Asia and the Monocle Daily later on. Before that, though, with the time at 32 minutes past the hour, Jonathan has the latest.
Thank you. At least 94 people have died and up to 250 are missing after a boat packed with African migrants caught fire and sank off the Sicilian island of Lampedusa. The disaster occurred when the boat's motor stopped working and the vessel began to take on water. People on board burnt a sheet to attract the attention of rescuers starting a fire on board. With the federal government shutdown in the US in its third day, President Obama has warned that the United States could be facing an even bigger financial crisis if the standoff is not resolved quickly. If a deal cannot be reached by the middle of October, the US government will run out of cash. India says its military is fighting a group who crossed the disputed border in Kashmir. Officials say that for more than a week they've been holed up in thick forests close to the line of control. And the UN Security Council has urged Syria's government to allow international aid to be delivered to areas most badly affected by the country's civil war. And that's the news on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. Jonathan will be back at the top of the hour with a full roundup of what's going on in the world. In the meantime, welcome back to Aperitivo, live here on Monocle 24. The time in Moscow is 21:34. It's 18:34 here in London, 14:34 in Rio. Let's cross to the cafe now. Alnoor Samji is cultural consultant at the Noor Festival of Arts. It's a festival that presents the best in contemporary art, film, literature, music and performance from the Middle East and North Africa. Alnoor is sitting next to Tom Edwards right now, enjoying their aperitivo. Tom, over to you.
Thank you very much, Matt. Yes, I'm here at the Monocle Cafe alongside Anora. Anora, welcome to Aperitivo. Thanks for joining me at the cafe. Let's talk about Nora Festival of Arts. What do you think it is about the event that so appeals to the audience here in London, in Kensington and Chelsea very specifically? It's going from strength to strength. Why do you think it's so popular?
I think you think about a number of things, Tom. First of all, Arabic is the second most widely spoken language in the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea. But even I think about as far back as 2007, the Spirit and Life exhibition at the Ismaili Centre drew over 25,000 people over a six-week period. And you look at the comments book then, you look at the comments book at Leighton House Museum, you look at previous Noor Festival research, and you see there is such an appetite and diverse range of requests. And that's not just from the visitors. You look at the artists, the local people in this country, and you look at people from overseas wanting to partner up, collaborate with organizations over here. So I think if you look at it as a total picture, there is a fantastic opportunity. One final bit, Tom, if you think about even this year's program, and there are 60 events over the 2 months, the first two were complete sellouts.
Yeah, and it's interesting, and I know that you're attending many of them as well. At launch night just a couple of evenings ago, you're a bit of a busy man. Let's talk about some of the specifics then. I'm intrigued by this exhibition about From Sinbad to Sci-Fi, sort of reimagining Arab science fiction. Now, this is perhaps not something that people would have been expecting, but it's really interesting, isn't it, to get under the surface of these kind of things, and I guess see how those kind of conceptions of something like sci-fi compares to maybe what the traditional Western view of that medium is.
So yes, hats off to Yasmin Khan for the fantastic salon last night. It was packed, such a wide range of comments, and I think if we look at Twitter, the kind of comments that are being made, and even Brian Whittaker's blog, fantastic. I think it's just capturing people's thinking. It's making people think about an area of writing that seems to have been Western, perhaps, but if you think about what's happened in other parts of the world, there are legacies and histories, and perfectly worthwhile material that's been produced in the past.
Absolutely, and another intriguing meeting of sort of the old and new, which I think is really interesting, is with Feroz Kod. This is the tradition and continuity in Afghan art, of course, and this is there's a lot of sort of historical artifacts, very ancient pieces, and then newer work by contemporary makers. And that's really interesting, isn't it? That meeting of the old and new, is that a sort of a trend that you see? Do you think quite often throughout the event?
I think again, hats off to the collaboration. Collaboration between the Museum of Islamic Art in Doha and Turquoise Mountain, with the support of British Council, taking original artifacts from the museum and getting Afghani artisans to produce not replicas, but contemporary material inspired by those original artifacts. And Leighton House Museum is going to be hosting that Fresco exhibition mid-November onwards. So that is something really to look forward to.
I hope all our London listeners are paying close attention, marking down all of these pieces of information. Huge variety, as you say, a great deal of variation in terms of what's on offer and where people can consume it. Let's talk a little bit about Huria, the animation installation by Soria Syed. This is really interesting, isn't it? Huge, again, breadth of collaboration. It really seems to be the watchword of the event this year. Music by Nitin Sawhney, a huge range. Collaboration, the coming together, the meeting of so many different cultures. It's very much about that, isn't it? A celebration of that.
Sure, and I'm so glad you asked to interview me today and not tomorrow, because the opening night for that Tahrir event is tomorrow, and I really would not have wanted to miss that for the earth.
It's good. I'm glad we've got you nice and fresh today.
Exactly. Inspired. But again, there's a dance event by Egyptian dancer Salah Albrogi at Leighton House later on. So listeners should really look at the website, norfestival.co.uk, and really book their spaces as quickly as they can, because things are really filling up.
Now, I wanted to just ask you one final question. It's interesting, I think some people still maybe fall into the trap, perhaps, of generalising slightly, looking at sort of all of the art and culture from this region as some kind of homogenous whole. And it's not really like that, is it? It's a much more multifaceted, there's much more variation. Do you think that's really the key message, perhaps, of the North Festival, that it's impossible to judge a book by its cover? There is a huge degree of variation, and the only way to really see exactly the wealth on offer is to visit all of these different events.
Absolutely, but, Tom, I think you captured that so well, but Crossways, Riffey Arts Collective, 5th of November, again, demonstrating that it's not one homogenous block. It's such a diversity, but not even diversity between countries, it's diversity within countries, and that too will be brought out at that event. So, yes, please, that's the Crossways is the one to look for.
Well, I'm sure that all of our listeners will be avidly writing down and making a note of your website just so they can get that again. It was noorfestival.co.uk. Elnor Sandy, thank you very much for coming to join us here at the cafe. That was Elnor. Emma, I hope you're booking your tickets, but for now, back to you in the studio.
Thanks, Tom. Just to remind everybody, Noor Festival of Arts runs from the 1st of October, 30th of November 2013 at more than 20 venues across Kensington and Chelsea here in the capital of the United Kingdom. You're listening to Aperitivo. Up next, we get a primer in Japanese erotica. Look away now.
The Glenlivet is the original Speyside single malt whiskey, and since 1824, its flavour has defined the region. Join master distiller Alan Winchester to determine the future of this historic distillery. Three new whiskies will set sail around the world, and members of the Guardians of the Glenlivet are invited to decide which will become the Guardians chapter. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
To report on the world, you need reporters around the world. With Bureau in Hong Kong and Tokyo, New York and Toronto, Zurich and, up next, Istanbul, Monocle 24 has a growing network of editors and correspondents. In Tokyo, Fiona Wilson.
From the Tokyo office, we cover everything from politics and business to architecture and design. We might be reporting on Shinzo Abe's radical economic policies or territorial tensions in the Senkaku Islands, as well as breaking news from around the region.
In Hong Kong, Aisha Spears.
From Monocle's Hong Kong office, we take stock of much of the Asia-Pacific region. We're watching everything from Xi Jinping's changing China to the Southeast Asian economies that are fast becoming hubs for young, creative business.
In New York, Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi.
From the New York Bureau, we cover the latest in food, travel and hospitality trends while keeping an eye on the business developments and political happenings in the US and the rest of the Americas.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And a very warm welcome back to Aperitivo with me, Emma Nelson. Now let's have a bit of game of comparison, shall we? Let's look at the art of Europe in the 19th century, a high-buttoned business, one could say. The realists reflected the changing world, the romantics heartened back. Most of it involved clothes. In Japan, however, things were taking a considerably racier turn. Shunga was an art form which lasted for around four centuries. It depicts the most intimate practices of the private lives of a nation, which at the time was pretty much closed off from the rest of the world. Now, a new exhibition of Shunga has just opened at the British Museum here in London. It includes everything from gay and lesbian erotica to orgy scenes, and as a result, it has an over 16s only admissions policy. Monocle's Innocent Abroad, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, went along to take a sneaky look.
Shunga literally means spring picture, and it's a genre of art from Japan that is sexually very explicit, sometimes also called pillow picture or laughter pictures, because there's a lot of humour in Shunga. We're talking broadly about the Edo period in Japanese history, which begins around 1600 and goes through to the middle of the 19th century. Shunga lingers on for about another 50 years during the Meiji era, but essentially it's disappeared as an art form by the early 20th century.
It's interesting because, I mean, the images are quite explicit, and maybe in some Western countries this probably there'll be a polemic if this would be considered art. So Japan approached this in a different way, right?
As you say, it's a completely different equation from what we used to, certainly in Western Europe, where from really early times, from the Renaissance certainly, it was impossible for leading artists to do sexually explicit works. It was illegal, it was banned by the church authorities, it was socially unacceptable. Japan was completely different. Artists of all schools in this period, Shunga was an accepted and expected part of their work.
Why was it produced? What was the market for it?
Well, I think if you're looking at the religious, the spiritual context for Shunga art, broadly, in Japanese society, unlike Christianity, the native religion of Japan, there's very little sense that sex or the pursuit of sexual pleasure is inherently sinful. It's just not something that is considered that bad. In fact, quite the reverse. And Shunga promotes a very positive view of sex, I think, to an extent an idealized view, some would say a fantasy view, but that is the nature of the art.
I was walking around the exhibition and I saw that actually even in Japan, Shunga was not viewed in a positive way on the 20th century, correct? Maybe because of the contact with Westerns.
There's a steady process of suppression of Shunga from the middle of the 19th century when Japan came back into sustained contact with the wider world. And as part of the modernization process for the country, it adopted a lot of contemporary values from Europe and North America. There was a sense in which Japan wanted to prove that it was a country similar to the Western European and American nations in order to be considered civilized. And one of the things that was jettisoned along the way was Shunga.
Can you just tell me like how Shunga in general was influential for artists like Picasso?
We are familiar with the story of Japanism. Japanese art, particularly Japanese prints, left the country and came to Europe in very, very large numbers in the second half of the 19th century, exciting Impressionist painters in a revolution that they'd already begun, and somehow Japanese prints seemed to confirm what they wanted to do. But part of the story, a really important part of the story that hasn't been understood much up till now, is, if you can call it, the secret Japanism. Within the Japanese prints that were coming to Europe, there was quite a lot of Shunga, and writers such as Edmond de Goncourt in Paris was championing Shunga as part of the work of Utamaro and Hokusai. And under influence from Edmond de Goncourt, Toulouse-Lautrec was given one of the most famous Shunga albums by Utamaro. We also know that in Britain, Aubrey Beardsley, the illustrator, was given a Shunga book by another artist. Picasso, in the 1930s, inherited a collection of about 70 Shunga works from a particular French diplomat. So just as he was working on the Vollard suite of prints, he received about 70 Shunga prints as a bequest. So it's a really interesting secret history of Japanism that needs to be uncovered.
Shall we walk around and see one of the main pieces of the exhibition?
We're looking at a painted hand scroll of the Kano school, and this is really an important discovery. It just came out of Japan in recent years and has been completely repaired in the British Museum, conserved by our specialist staff. So it looks really beautiful now. And it's important because the Kano school were painting for the elite of Japan. They were painting for the samurai aristocracy, for the court aristocracy, and for leading temples and shrines. They only paint for the elite. So this kind of work proves once and for all that Shunga was used and enjoyed by all sections of Japanese society. It has this beautiful sprinkling of gold and silver leaf across the back of the painting, which gives this incredible sense of luxury. Very high quality pigments, including gold leaf used on some of the costumes of the women. So this is an artifact of a very high order and clearly was meant to be treasured and handed down in a family over many generations. It's lasted 400 years up to now.
Tina, I have a question. I mean, even though, of course, they are clearly explicit images, they're so beautiful somehow that you almost, if you look very quickly, you forget it. Yeah, you forget that.
I think Shunga is a powerful rhetoric, and it lulls you into a sense of security where you're not so disturbed by how explicit the works are. But that's the point, that sex is not regarded as something that is innately threatening or sinful. There's a celebration of the pleasure, the mutual pleasure involved. This is interesting scroll, though, because the very first scene, it's actually two men in bed together. There's an older man and a youth, according to the accepted social practices of the way of youths. where male-male sex was acceptable within certain social contexts. But then we switched to a threesome, where a man and a woman having sex in front of a screen, and another woman is pulling the other woman's hair. Whether she wants her to stop or whether she wants to join in is not clear. Here we're moving to a set of colour prints called Hand Scroll for the Sleeve, which was produced in the middle of the 1780s. Full colour printing began in Japan around 1765, so the technology is still fairly new. But the block carving and the colour printing has already reached really exquisite technical standards. It's a very unusual format, these narrow horizontal prints. And we know that originally they would have been all stuck together, 12 sheets, and then rolled around a little central spool to form a hand scroll that could literally be tucked into somebody's sleeve and then produced and shown to friends or associates. But the artist is Torii Kiyonaga, and Kiyonaga is really one of the most brilliant figure draftsmen in the whole Japanese art tradition. And this series, I think, really expresses very well the mutuality of the sexual pleasure. We chose for our poster subject a detail of the couple kissing, but when you see the whole print and just their naked bodies hugging one another very closely, and then a red undergarment, which kind of shock of colour against the white bodies, but they're completely lost in bliss. But you also get a scene like this where the couple have finished the sex and they're just kind of drowsing in a kind of peaceful state of bliss after the sex is over. So it's not all about performance. This is a series, The Adonis Flower, which is dated to the early 1820s, and it's by the celebrated artist Hokusai. And I think many people will be familiar with Hokusai's Great Wave print. The famous Great Wave print is about 10 years after this set, so Hokusai is working his way up to that. But in formal terms, they're incredible. Figures are very large and bold, complicated poses. It takes you a while sometimes to figure out whose leg is who, whose arm is who. But that's Hokusai enjoying the challenge of playing with the forms of the bodies within the confines of the sheet of paper. And they really are big figures which kind of push towards the edge of the sheet. This is the development you find in 19th century prints, where you get conversations between the lovers, opening up a whole new dimension in the images. They're very direct. It's generally the lovers saying, do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that, let's make love five more times. It's absurd often, but it's intended to be enjoyable and raise a laugh as people are looking at the pictures.
And that was Tim Clark, curator of the new exhibition at the British Museum, talking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Shunga, Sex and Pleasure in Japanese Art is on now at the British Museum in London. You're listening to Aperitivo.
From London.
To New York.
To Tokyo. To Buenos Aires.
To Zurich. To Hong Kong.
To Toronto.
To Berlin.
To Tel Aviv,
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24, fast approaching the end of today's programme. But before we go, let's look ahead to what's coming up a little later on. Annabelle Bly is producer of The Globalist Asia, which airs at 2000 hours London time. Daphne Denis, producer of The Monocle Daily, airing 2 hours later. They both join me in the studio. Welcome, ladies. Annabelle, you want to talk about Xi Jinping on his travels again?
Yes, he's travelling around Southeast Asia at the moment. And he's doing what Obama's not, which is wooing the various nations there and offering them lots of trade opportunities and economic partnerships.
Well, Obama has obviously been told to hurry back home because he has bigger things to deal with at home. Plus the fact, I think he's had to cut short his trip to the Philippines as a result. Who are we going to be talking to about this?
We'll be talking to Steve Tang, who's the director of the China Policy Institute at Nottingham University.
What's his take on this? Do we know?
We'll be finding out at 2000 hours London time.
Also, we're going to be talking about football, a subject really beloved of Monocle 24. How are we squeezing that into our otherwise sport-free agenda?
Unfortunately, we won't be talking about the beautiful game itself, more the machinations of those who are controlling when it is going to be played.
Go on.
So the World Cup, will it be moved from summer to winter? That is the big question on everyone's mind at the moment.
Well, it's FIFA is expected to agree to move the 2022 World Cup from its traditional slot. Who's going to be in the studio for that?
We are going to have a investigative journalist called Andrew Jennings, who has spent his career pretty much investigating FIFA.
He's the man who chases Sepp Blatter,
yes,
isn't he? That's all he does. There anybody with an idle few minutes should just look up on the internet what this gentleman's activities are. You always get these wonderful moments on the internet of him sort of popping up behind Sepp Blatter like some unwelcome meerkat, asking him how corrupt FIFA is. It is always an absolute pleasure, but you always do have to give him a gentle legal warning before we ever let him on air. 2 hours later at 2200 hours London time, Daphne Denis will be here behind the glass in the control room. Who will be your hosts tonight?
Well, we'll have a lot of different hosts, but we'll have... Sorry, you meant hosts.
I did.
Andrew Mueller.
Of course.
And Tyke Enright.
Oh, how lovely. Boys' night. What will you be talking about?
We're talking about Republicans hating Republicans again and mushrooms.
We'll move on to mushrooms in a moment because I am agog. But the Republicans hating the Republicans, I can only assume this is people moving against the Tea Party movement.
Indeed, yes. Obviously, as you can imagine, the Tea Party is getting some Republicans bored, the ones that are perhaps a little bit more reasonable than their crazy affiliated members. So some donors are actually withdrawing their funds from the Republican Party, and this could have really big impact on the party itself if this continues.
Yeah, the last time the US government went into shutdown 17 years ago under Bill Clinton's administration, there was an enormous long-term, very damaging effect on the Republicans that people basically held them responsible for holding the country to ransom. Having said that, I mean, James D. Boies a few minutes ago on Aperitivo was talking about how Barack Obama had complained that one small faction of one small party had managed to completely throw a spanner in the works. And James Boies was arguing that that is in fact what constitutional law is all about. Parliament cannot bind itself. It cannot bind its successors. People can always pick and unpick what's going on.
Absolutely, but it's still very difficult for a party to just realise that you're sort of doing everything that you're doing because of a small crazy bit of your party. And I think that's what they're realizing now after years of following them.
You mentioned mushrooms.
Yes, mushrooms, and a mushroom in particular, the matsutake.
Right.
A mushroom that can be picked in Oregon and that is booming. It's very expensive, $5 a pound, and everyone loves it. Loves it in New York.
What do you use your matsutake for?
Well, you can eat it. You should eat it.
I should hate
it.
I mean,
I'm not sure about recipes, but we're going to talk to Langdon Cook, someone who's got a very good name for what he's going to be talking about. And he is a mushroom expert who will hopefully share his mushroom recipes with us.
And this is not just coming from the United... from Japan. The matsutake is actually gaining popularity.
No. You can pick it up in Oregon, United States.
Wonderful. I look forward to hearing Tyge and Andrew wrestling with the idea of mushroom recipes. Anything else on the agenda that we need to talk about?
We'll have a really nice report from an exhibition in Buenos Aires. And we'll ask if the Commonwealth is worth anything anymore, as Gambia has withdrawn from it.
Daphne Denis, producer of The Monocle Daily, airing at 2200 hours at London time. Thank you. And Annabelle, producer of The Globalist Asia. Thank you too, ladies. That's all we have time for today's Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Robert Fox, defence editor at London's Evening Standard, and to Dr. James Boies, visiting senior research fellow at King's College London too. They both talked us through the Greenpeace activists in Russia and also spoke about the latest US government shutdown crisis. Here's a little of what Robert Fox had to say.
Congress and Obama are conducting themselves so badly because this could have been spotted a mile away. It's proved yet again what a lousy politician Obama is.
Today's show was produced by Danny Jacopelli. It was researched by James Bullock. Our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Next up, after the news, The Urbanist, where Tom Edwards will take a look at feral cities, those where the citizens have taken the reins and are making things happen themselves.
We need more people to get involved, and I think that people are not sure what are the values of citizen participation in things, and they don't know they have right to the city and they can really do some action in their city.
After that, as you've just heard, at 2000 hours London time, we have the Globalist Asia, and then at 2200 hours, the Monocle Daily will be talking Republicans and mushrooms. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time, but for this edition of Aperitivo, goodbye and thank you very much for listening.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.